This is America breaking their promise with our nation's men and women in uniform, and it's unprecedented.
Alaska veterans push for Congress to restore full pension benefits. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, 61 degrees in Seward, 51 degrees in Nome. Is it January or Junuary?
This is one of those dramatic excursions that kind of get weather people excited.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. A message to parents from the Alaska Department of Education. Learning to read is the basis for all future learning. Parents can help their children get off to a good start as readers. Read with your young children every day. Do lots of talking with your kids. Make up stories together. Play games with words like rhyming games. Encourage your kids to write and draw stories and ask your school how you can help your children become good readers. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
Veterans and military members in Alaska and around the country have been outraged at Congress since December when lawmakers passed a budget that would trim their retirement benefits starting in 2015. All three members of Alaska's congressional delegation voted for that budget, even though they oppose the military pension decrease. Senator Mark Begich today stood with a group of veterans before a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing and pledged to restore the nearly $6 billion in cuts. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
At first, the cut doesn't sound like much. It would drop a retiree's cost of living adjustment below the inflation rate until the veteran reaches age 62. But some enlistees retire and start collecting their pensions while still in their 30s, so this COLA cut could mean diminished benefits for 2.5 decades. Paul Rykoff, founder of the group Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, says for some individuals, it adds up to an $80,000 sacrifice.
But I think most importantly of all, it's a broken promise. This is America breaking their promise with our nation's men and women in uniform, and it's unprecedented.
Alaska has more veterans per capita than any other state, and they're relatively young. More than a quarter of them have served since 2001. It's no surprise, then, that Alaska's congressional delegation is getting an earful. Senator Begich says he's heard from more than 800 Alaskans objecting to the cut.
I can tell you the calls that are coming into my office are about three to one over the next most popular issue, health care. This issue has taken front and center.
Begich defends his vote for the budget containing the COLA cut, saying it was necessary to prevent another government shutdown. More than a dozen bills have been introduced to roll back the COLA cut. It's a popular position in Congress, and Begich, running for re-election this year, sides with the veterans.
When these heroes signed up to serve and made the military a career, it's what they were promised, and they expect it. And they should expect no less now.
He isn't proposing a specific way to pay for the rollback, but says finding the money, $6 billion over 10 years, won't be too difficult. Some lawmakers are proposing to take it out of the defense budget, exactly what the Pentagon fears. Admiral James Winnefeld, vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that something must be done to rein in personnel costs, which he says are unsustainably high. He says military compensation has been climbing since the 1990s and is now higher on average when compared to equivalent civilian jobs. Winnefeld says the growing cost threatens the Defense Department's ability to prepare the troops.
In the end, we believe the most important way we keep the fantastic young men and women who volunteer to defend our nation is to only send them into combat with the best possible training and equipment we can provide. Controlling compensation growth in a tough budget environment will help us do just that.
But even he says he can't support the COLA cut that Congress passed. Winnefeld says such a change should include a grandfather clause to exempt current retirees and service members. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Rural Alaska's infrastructure is young. Many homes still use honey buckets. A lot of the funding to build the infrastructure comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA funds water and sewer, as well as housing, energy, and communications projects, and even ones that support growing local food. Today, the Undersecretary of the USDA Rural Development, Patrice Kunish, visited the Bethel region to see some of the projects in action. Kunish and an entourage from D.C. and Anchorage toured the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, met with the Association of Village Council President's officers, and stopped into Myers Farm. Tim Myers has started growing so much local produce on the tundra in Bethel, he's now exporting to Anchorage and Bristol Bay. Kunish says the USDA is committed to making sure locally grown foods support the community, both economically and nutritionally.
One of the things we've seen in some of the harshest conditions is folks just not getting good, fresh food. It compromises health. It compromises our vitality.
Jim Norland is the USDA Rural Development Alaska State Director and was acting as tour guide.
As Alaskans, we're pretty good at providing protein as we have wild fish and game in our freezers. But what's really missing from a lot of rural Alaska is the access to fresh fruits and vegetables.
Kunish is also visiting two villages, housing projects in Quinnahock and conservation projects in Kuithluk. The Bethel area visit is part of a three-day Alaska tour. Kunish will be in Anchorage on Wednesday and Juneau on Thursday. A Fairbanks substance abuse counselor is pushing for the state to consider an alternative to jail for drug offenders. SKUAC's Dan Bross reports the effort is in response to a steady stream of young heroin addicts, some of whom end up in jail.
Fairbanks has a heroin problem. That's the warning from Gunnar Ebbesen, clinical director at Turning Point Counseling Services.
I have been noticing a pattern of young people coming in, typically between the age of 18 and 24. I get between 3 and 5 phone calls a week from either desperate parents or friends or addicts themselves seeking treatment for opioid addiction.
Ebbesen attributes the problem to young people who start with prescription pain relievers, get hooked, and then switch to heroin to feed their addiction.
And so that's kind of the evolution of the problem in Fairbanks. It's at an epidemic level.
Ebbesen says treatment's available through private clinics and Fairbanks Native Association's Gateway to Recovery program, but some addicts don't get help and follow a downward spiral that results in other illegal behaviors.
They get put in jail where they really learn how to use, really learn how to resent society, and don't get the treatment they need, and re-enter society where they continue the cycle. And so, I'm a very strong advocate for public policy that changes that paradigm.
Ebbesen wants the state to set up a special drug court in Fairbanks, a treatment-centered correctional alternative that works with the criminal justice system to provide nonviolent offenders a way out of the cycle of addiction and crime.
They go in front of a judge. He says, okay, so what I need you to do is go get an evaluation and follow the recommendations of the evaluation. And then once a month, you'll come in front of me and we'll track your progress. And after 18 months, if you complete the program successfully, you'll have your felony or your misdemeanor waived.
Ebbesen says the approach has proven to have a 75% success rate in other states. He says it's also cheaper than jail. Director of the State Department of Law's Criminal Division, John Skidmore, says Alaska is experimenting with therapeutic courts for substance abuse and mental health-related offenses, including in Anchorage and Bethel.
We're trying to look for ways to make the criminal justice system more effective and more efficient, and if we find one that we think works, then we're certainly going to be looking at expanding it.
Skidmore contends therapeutic courts are more costly in the short run because of the number of people involved.
The judge, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, the treatment providers, they are all coming to court on a regular basis on this one case or multiple cases and talking about what's the status of what's going on here. Is that more time and resource intensive than it would have been to simply prosecute the case? Yes.
Skidmore says it's yet to be determined whether benefits outweigh the costs in terms of achieving success, offenders staying off drugs and out of trouble. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Tok looks to biomass for power and heat.
If you look around the state, you don't find anywhere else with the available timber resource and the high cost of utility. So this is the best place to make it work.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Temperature records fell across the state yesterday, with highs in the 40s, 50s, and even 60s. Much of the state is experiencing weather that feels more like May or June than January. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Port Allsworth on Lake Clark was the warmest spot in the state Monday at 62 degrees, the highest temperature ever recorded in Alaska in January. Nome hit 51 degrees, the highest midwinter temperature recorded there. Rick Toman is climate program manager for the National Weather Service in Fairbanks. He says a big high pressure system has been stuck over most of the state.
It's lasted almost 10 days now, so this has provided a lot of time for warm air to be moved north to melt snow in places that normally have snow cover this time of year and produce lots of temperature extremes.
Seward hit 61 degrees on Monday. It was 57 in Homer. Even the Brooks Range has seen temperatures in the 40s. The length of the warm spell is noteworthy. Toman says you have to go back to the late 1970s or early 80s to find anything similar.
This is one of those dramatic excursions that kind of get weather people excited.
In Girdwood, home to Alyeska Ski Resort, this dramatic excursion from normal winter elicits a very different reaction.
I just looked up the mountain and it's frightful right now.
Stephanie Flynn co-owns The Bake Shop, a popular restaurant at the base of Alyeska. The ski resort closed indefinitely yesterday due to poor conditions. Flynn says The Bake Shop will stay open, but business has been slow.
We see very unhappy, sad-looking customers. But we also see that, of course, the numbers are lacking. We don't get as many people into our restaurant for lunch or breakfast. So we do see the impact here, especially on the weekends.
Flynn says the raspberries in her yard are leafing out. She's hoping winter will return quickly with a healthy dump of snow. But Rick Toman from the National Weather Service says that's not likely anytime soon. He says the warm temperatures will begin to moderate, but snow isn't in the forecast for at least the next few weeks.
It really does not appear that we will see significant snowfall over most of Alaska, so that places that have lost their snow cover or have it a serious ice cover on their snow are not likely to get much relief from that. And really, at this point, in the next 2 weeks, we do not see temperatures really dramatically below normal most anywhere in Alaska.
A recent Facebook post offered what may be the shortest and most accurate way to describe the unusual weather, Junuary. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Warm temperatures have depleted Alaska's snowpack and melted river ice. Residents of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta have noticed more open water in recent weeks. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
It's not technically breakup, but in many places, it sure looks and feels like it. George Bright Sr. is a VPSO in Good News Bay. He woke up Monday morning and saw open water.
I mean, it's like springtime, yeah? Open water.
He says Good News Bay and all three rivers that combine and empty into the bay are open.
The news just spread, so we might have some people going out seal hunting, maybe going up river and seining for trouts, stuff like that, yeah?
James Charles lives in Tuntutuliak. He says there's open water in front of Tuntutuliak Slough from Hellamick Point on down to the mouth of the river.
It usually freezes by this time and has been frozen by December, January, but this time it's open all the way.
He says people are not traveling by snow machine on the river, but are going on a tundra trail instead. He says high tides are leading to some extensive overflow in low areas. Scott Lindsay is a hydrologist for the Alaska Pacific River Forecast Center. He says the warm temperatures and rain are certainly unusual, but the Kuskokwim as a whole is not immediately at risk of breaking up.
In order to really get breakup going, we'd have to have either a big rainfall event like we had several years ago, or temperatures where you had above freezing up to higher elevations. You know, there's still a lot of snow up in the mountains, and in order to start breakup to really push down the river, you'd have to get a push of snow melt coming from the mountains, and I don't anticipate that that's going to happen right now.
Bethel can expect above normal temperatures throughout the week, with highs above freezing through Friday. For KYUK, I'm Ben Matheson.
The community of Tok hosts a thick, growing forest of spruce trees and a thinning, shrinking population of people and businesses. Like elsewhere in rural Alaska, high energy costs and a lack of jobs are causing people to leave. But the trees may be the solution to bringing people back. APRN's Ann Hillman learned more.
Tok is in the midst of an energy crisis. Electricity costs 51 cents per kilowatt hour for businesses, 3.5 times the price in Anchorage. Heating oil is over $4 a gallon. Community members are looking for a new solution.
Tok seems to be the best place in the state of Alaska for biomass power and heat.
That's Jeremy Rogers with Dawson Energy. He says the company can get private capital to back a 2-megawatt biomass plant. It would use wood chips to provide both power and heat to the entire community.
If you look around the state, you don't find anywhere else with the available timber resource and the high cost of utility. So this is the best place to make it work.
It's already being done on a small scale at the Tok School. Rogers' company and the local utility, AP&T, have played with the idea for nearly 5 years, but it's never gotten off the ground. AP&T spokesperson and Chamber of Commerce Vice President Dave Stancliffe says that's because they never had all of the players, like the utility, the financiers, the harvesters, and the community members, at the same table. And now, he says, they're more motivated than ever.
The economic health of the community, the social health of the community are all at stake with the high cost of energy. And we have enrollment in the school that's gone down. We have people that are moved out of Tok because they can't afford to pay the power bills and their heating bills.
Stancliffe argues that getting the fuel source locally will create more jobs and keep money in the community. Mickey Hinton is AP&T's power operations manager for the Interior Division. He says the plant could stabilize power costs, but he mostly sees it as a source of heat.
Heat would be the primary resource we think would be the most profitable and most economical is the heat. Electrical would be secondary. Location of the plant would be critical to make this happen. We have to have it centrally located. My understanding can only go so far with the heat for reliabilities, for gaining what you want out of the heat.
Tony Lee is a local contractor who recently formed a nonprofit to organize people around the idea of the community biomass plant. He also thinks location could make or break the project.
My vision for this plant, for the maximum impact in this community, is placed where we have an industrial park.
Lee says that could inspire new businesses to sell things like kiln-dried firewood and wood pellets. But Lee also says he has reservations. Heat loops that connect businesses are incredibly expensive. But he doesn't see any other options.
In order to strive and thrive in the future, we've got to reimagine ourselves. And the only thing we really have going for us is biomass.
The Division of Forestry is ready to offer 25-year contracts to harvest 700 to 900 acres of woody biomass per year. Forester Peter Tallis explains that cutting the trees would solve two problems, powering the community and reducing the risk of wildfires.
Basically thin out the forest so that it's just not so dense, so thick, that the fire burns really hot and really intense. And by reducing that intensity, it gives our firefighters a greater chance at knocking that fire down.
Tallis says wildfires can quickly spread through the community because of the dense stands of trees. Jeremy Rogers from Dawson Energy says they should know within 6 months if it's worth it to go ahead with the project or not. In Tok, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
For more than 20 years, NIOSH has been working to prevent accidental deaths in the fishing industry. Now, these safety experts are tackling injuries, the kind fishermen are used to getting every season. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, that might make this a tougher problem to solve.
In her time at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, Jennifer Lincoln says she's found a common cause behind the most serious fishing accidents.
You know, if you ask me what leads to fatalities in the fishing industry, it's drowning, it's vessel losses and falls overboard.
Lincoln directs the Alaska Field Office for NIOSH. Their commercial fishing experts have been studying fatal accidents since 1991. Using their research, they've come up with a slew of mechanical gadgets, like door monitors and emergency winch stops, that make boats safer. But Lincoln says it's not clear if there's a button or sensor out there that can keep fishermen from getting hurt.
What we don't know, what we don't have as much information about, are non-fatal injuries.
Injuries aren't tracked like fatalities, in part because they're so common. But getting hurt can have big implications for a fisherman, like lost time and wages. If a problem goes untreated at sea for too long, it can lead to more serious ailments. And that can be painful. Jake Jacobson has fished in the crab fleet. He can rattle off some gruesome accidents.
I know guys that have had their foot smashed and bones broken when we were fishing way out west in the Aleutians, and they just stayed on the boat and wrapped it in a plastic bag and ran the crane until they could get to town and have a doctor look at it.
Unalaska's clinic sees a lot of those patients. That's why Lincoln from NIOSH teamed up with a state epidemiologist to study the local patient load. Lincoln says they looked through the Unalaska clinic's medical charts from 2007 to 2008.
What was interesting to me is that in that two-year time period, a fisherman came in every other day to the clinic to be treated for a traumatic injury.
Most of the time, that was a sprain or contusion. It usually happened while they were catching fish or processing it.
They were hit by something or struck by something or crushed by something.
That could be fishing gear or even a box of frozen fish stored aboard a processing vessel. Those are pretty basic observations. Lincoln says there are some useful takeaways.
Sometimes there's a lot of time that goes by before they're seen at the clinic, and so the people on the vessel need to be properly trained in managing the injury.
Lincoln is sharing these results with safety officers at fishing companies. Eventually, she wants to be able to find the patterns in how fishermen get injured. That would require a bigger pool of data, which Lincoln says NIOSH can get by teaming up with the State Fisherman's Fund and the Coast Guard. Once they figure out the underlying causes, NIOSH can start suggesting tools to cut down on accidents. But they're never going to be able to eliminate them, says Jake Jacobson. He started out as a fisherman and now oversees about 80 crab boats in the Intercooperative Exchange. Jacobson says ending the derby-style fishery made crabbing safer, but still.
You get knocked around a bit out on there, on deck.
That leads to lots of small injuries when accidents happen.
If they're little things, that fishermen are kind of disinclined to talk about it anyway, because it's just, you get over it.
And even if you can cut down on the risk of accidents, it's a lot harder to change the culture of fishing, the expectation of long hours, big payoffs, and the battle scars to show for it. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal, with help from Stephanie Joyce in Seattle.
The Alaska Board of Fish will begin deliberations on the Cook Inlet fisheries in Anchorage next week. One of the more difficult issues before the board is the declining king salmon runs and demands by sport fishing interests to shut down the commercial catch of reds to let every king into the Kenai River system. Johanna Urich reports on an attempt to use science to find a way to reduce the number of kings showing up in commercial fishing nets.
In Cook Inlet, the statewide decline of king salmon has raised the long-running Cook Inlet fish war between commercial and sports fishermen to a fever pitch. Last summer, Eastside set netters became the latest casualty as their fishery was shut down by a fish board dominated by sports fishermen. In the middle of that battle, Working almost unnoticed was a group of scientists wielding high-tech tools. David Welch's company, Kintama, deployed receivers and inserted radio tags into two species of Cook Inlet salmon, the sockeye reds targeted by commercial fishermen and the Chinook kings treasured by sports fishermen, to gather data on where these fish are as they swim to spawning grounds in the Kenai and Kasilof rivers. Welch and his team shoved the tags down salmon throats.
Well, it's basically about the size of a tube of lipstick.
Last week, Welch presented an animated map showing the path the salmon took. The data he gathered documented in real time how far each tagged fish was from shore and how deep it swam. Fish biologists have known for a long time that Chinooks prefer the bottom and sockeyes like the surface, but till now they have not had hard data. On the map, the tagged sockeyes, marked in red, swam further offshore until they got close to the river's mouth.
But then when they're coming into the Kenai River, they move quite quickly into the Kenai.
That behavior contrasted with the Chinooks, who stayed close to shore and tended to hang out there for 20 days before making a dash into the river.
On a flood tide, basically, so that they probably get away from seals and other predators that are waiting at the river mouth.
Welch's study is good news for the Cook Inlet drift fishermen because it shows little potential for Chinook interceptions in their fishery. But the picture for Eastside set netters is less clear. There's a big problem in Welch's work. There were no receivers in the mile-and-a-half segment right off the shore where the set net sites are located.
We can do that, but we just didn't have enough time to build the equipment that's needed, because that's a very tough area. It's very shallow, big tides, big waves, so we have to build specialized containers for the receivers so they'll survive long enough.
Welch hopes the state will give him the money to capture better fish behavior data to help resolve the allocation battles in Cook Inlet to the benefit of all human users.
One of the things that we hope we can do is to use the depth data so that the sockeye fishermen can design their nets so that they can catch the sockeye while minimizing interceptions of Chinook. So hopefully we can put the data on the table so that the folks can sit down and figure out what might be done.
Till now, no one has bothered to ask the salmon what they think of the fish wars, but there may be a hint in Welch's study, which found two kings that wanted no part of it. They headed out as far and as fast as they could.
We got a call while we're still out tagging that it was caught in Uyak Bay in the northern part of Kodiak Island.
The other rogue king headed south, where he was found 2 months later in the mouth of the Columbia River. I'm Johanna Urich.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes and Ben Matheson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Johanna Urich in Anchorage. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Ann Hillman from Tok. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. Alaska's public schools have new standards in English and math, setting high expectations for students. Students who meet these goals will be ready for success after high school, whether in the military, on the job, or in an apprenticeship, technical school, or college. Ask your school for parent guides to the standards or learn more online at education.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.